KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As Tropical Storm Harvey bears down on Louisiana today, we're going to get the latest on the storm that left large parts of Houston underwater from UC Berkeley Professor of Energy Dan Kamen. We're also going to talk with him about why he resigned last week from his appointment as a science envoy for the State Department. And welcome back to Forum, Dan Kamen. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
I guess let's begin with your resignation. I really want to get your assessment of what's going on in Harvey and ties to climate change, because to a great extent it has been probably, especially in Texas, understated. But although it did come up in a conversation we had with a Texas reporter who's been covering things down there. But when you resigned, and you resigned with an acrostic that spelled out impeach, which I presume was maybe inspired by a letter of resignation from the president of the Committee on Arts and
Arts and Culture,
yeah, because they had spelled out resist. You spelled out impeach. But I want to find out what motivated you here. I mean, it was Charlottesville, but it was Charlottesville on top of climate change and withdrawing from the Paris Accord, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it really pained me to have to do it. But my job as science envoy was actually to engage African and Middle East governments on energy and climate. And pulling out of Paris was, in my view, a direct step away from my mission statement as science envoy. But I really wanted to give the administration a chance, and Mr. Trump had indicated that he wanted to, quote unquote, cut a different or better deal for the United States, which I found ironic and incorrect because actually the U.S. Greatly crafted the Paris deal. But that being said, if you're going to negotiate, that would be an interesting thing to watch and maybe even assist. But nothing was forthcoming. There is no science envoy at present. That's one of the many offices that have remained vacant across the government. And that alone pushed me to the edge, because I don't feel it's in the best interest of the United States or the planet. But the Charlottesville response, in my view, as a citizen, was completely unacceptable. And diplomacy is not just a foreign process, it's a domestic one. And certainly enabling the alt-right, neo-Nazi, white hate, whatever you want to call the groups, just does not fit at all with my principles. And we've now seen the revelations of this Trump Tower deal in Moscow. There's an ongoing series. And so my statement, and the reason why I went to what I view as a very extreme and painful place to have to write impeach in the acrostic, was that in no uncertain terms, I would say Mr. Trump is very simply putting his own interests above that of the nation, perhaps his own business and political interests, if you want to nuance it a bit. But that's just simply not presidential. And
how did you stay on, though? You were part of the Obama administration. I was frankly surprised to see that they kept you on in the Trump administration.
Well, actually, the position, while set up under Obama, had the funding support, not for me. It's actually an unpaid position, but it's one that supports work in the embassies, and there's money for travel, and there's money to support the efforts that the embassies put on. And so it was essentially a budget item that was put together and was funded before Mr. Trump came in. But the longer term view is that engaging in governments around the world, whether it's on climate or energy, is generally seen as positive for U.S. businesses and very positive for regional stability. And that was why I think it carried over into the Trump term.
Yeah, well, you have also been critical of the fact that there's a rescinding of the Clean Power Plan, which to a great extent, I think you've indicated you believe will hurt the red states most of all. And those are the people who rally to the Trump presidency. We're talking about a lot of money there. And speaking of a lot of money, I want to get to something else. There was an article in Breitbart, which I suppose you saw, and there was some strong criticism of you. They said, you know, you're not green, you're gangrene. It was pretty harsh stuff. And it went back to Prop 87 and all that money that came into essentially oil for subsidizing oil research and so forth with a specific kind of alternative energy that didn't really come through with high marks or with the expectations that you and others had in terms of productivity and so forth. The reason I bring that up, though, is they were after your what they called your voodoo science, but they also criticized you pretty harshly for the sophistry, I think was the word they used, and the juvenile nature of using that acrostic and resigning the way you did. And that came across also from a woman who was a Republican committee woman here in California, Harriet Dillon, who said, you know, you're too politically correct, and you're really hurting more the people that you're supposed to be helping in Africa and the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I couldn't disagree with any of that more. I mean, first of all, I would regard it as a bit of a badge of honor to be picked on by Breitbart. Certainly not a source of quality news by any means. And the argument that was put forward that somehow using the language of one's resignation letter to indicate multiple messages is actually a long-standing political tradition of the left and right in U.S. And British history. And so I regard the form of using the letter to express one's opinions is actually highly political and a useful way to have a dialogue with both sides. And we can see by how much of a viral response it got that certainly it got people talking about the issues. It got people talking about the degree to which the president's actions are stepping away from a role of international leadership. And I think that the story from California, from New York State, from Wisconsin, from Florida, many states that have invested in green, is that the global economy is simply putting more money and more effort into the emerging solar, wind, energy storage, geothermal, sustainable hydro, a whole variety of technologies. And to step away from that now is just simply bad business. So we have multiple groups from the left and from the right, university groups, think tanks in the U.S. and Europe and Asia, all finding that again and again. And so for a someone elected on a business, smaller government, good trade for the U.S. platform, this is just simply a bad business decision, irrespective of its damage to the planet.
Well, talking about damage to the planet, Louisiana is going through terrible travails because of Harvey. And I wanted to bring up climate change with you, particularly in light of what happened in Louisiana, what may be happening in more places because of climate change not being attended to the ways that it ought to be. And let's talk about the relationship there, the connection as you see it.
Yeah, so this is a, I mean, first of all, it's just horribly sad to see the level of devastation. I mean, they've seen 50 inches of rain at Mary's Creek in southeast Houston. These are numbers that we just do not see. And the debate has been, just as you say, how much can we attribute? And that's exactly where climate science, while good science, may not be good journalism, because before and during and even after some events, you simply cannot give a percentage. You can't say an event like Harvey is X percent worse. What's telling, though, is that with 15 deaths so far, at least $100 billion in costs, and that's just so far in climbing, over 30, and I've now seen 50,000 displaced peoples, that the World Meteorological Association issued its statement yesterday. And what it said in the somewhat couch language of science is that climate change makes storms like Harvey more intense, more destructive, and more costly. And a number of scholars have gone on to note that, in fact, one of the huge tragedies is not just the scale, but the huge environmental justice impact, that the poorest African-American minority communities have the weakest infrastructure, the longest response times. And so in whatever fraction we eventually determine Harvey to be driven by climate change, and that fraction is not zero. It's certainly larger than that. This is an economic, but it's also a social and an environmental justice crisis.
It's fair to say, is it not, that Texas has been pretty much ignoring this connection that you've just outlined for us, or, excuse me, the connection that exists between climate change and the sort of disaster we see it? And Harvey, and I'm not just talking about Ted Cruz here. I'm talking about, for example, Rick Perry, who is now head of the Department
Secretary
of Energy.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly true. If you look at the news reports, Myron Abell, sort of the super conservative, quote-unquote, architect, if you call it that, of the current EPA, a number of others have come out trying to distance themselves, to minimize the impact, to say we've had a relatively low set of hurricanes in the last few years. But the fact is that the climate change science is predicting exactly events like this. Whether we determine that Harvey was 10 or 15 or 20 or 50 or some other percent made more intense or more likely because of climate change, we know this is exactly the kind of event we expect. And so a few years ago, when there were horrible droughts in Russia and Australia and in Europe, those were events that were also entirely consistent with climate change. And so when conservative non-scientists want to minimize the impact, I mean, that's literally sticking in your head in the sand, or I guess in this case in Houston, it's sticking your head in the mud and polluted water.
Also, in the pavement, we talked about with the Texas Reporter I mentioned about the fact that there's so much development in that area of Texas, particularly in Houston and around that southeastern part of Texas, that the development has certainly led to some of the problems that we're seeing now. What about ties to the petrochemical industry? How do you see that all fitting in this calculus?
Well, so it's, again, a tricky story. I mean, you're right. Houston and the Louisiana corridor, where Harvey is now making its second landfall, getting a double dose of this, is, of course, that's the oil and gas alley of the United States. It is overbuilt in terms of infrastructure with non-permeable paved areas, gravel areas, and a lot of low-income housing. So certainly that sets it up very badly. But the other feature, of course, is that we are not only using the Louisiana oil gulch to push for a greater amount of oil and gas in our economy, but the battle over the Keystone Pipeline and others are actually really about importing even dirtier flavors of raw materials to make oil and gas from as far away as Western and Canada, and to refine it there, ironically, to send it overseas. And so the levels of kind of this negative feedback of doubling down on a dirty and polluting economy that clearly is affecting climate change based on the science, not based on the politics, is the larger worrying story about burying our heads and not listening to when the science come forward. And that's why I say that, you know, my harshest statement about Mr. Trump is that he's just putting his own interests above that of the nation. And I see the science of climate change is very clear. The global community does. And to ignore it is to really let go of an opportunity to lead, an opportunity to build American jobs and climate stability.
We're talking about Tropical Storm Harvey with Dan Kamen, professor of energy at UC Berkeley. And we started talking with him about his recent resignation as science envoy in the U.S. Department of State. And you may want to join this conversation. You may want to talk to Dan Kamen with any questions or comments you have. And we welcome your calls. You can join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program again. You can do that by calling us at 866-733-6786. You also can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting your questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and simply click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And let me go to some comments that are coming in here and get some responses from you, Dan. William says, do scientists need to redefine 50, 100, 500-year weather events?
So evidently we do. I mean, events, when you look in the historical record, that we thought were exactly those, once in 100 years, once in 500 years, are happening much more frequently. And the one that keeps getting attention is the pace of acidification. We've just seen a scarily good movie called Chasing Coral, following on the Chasing Ice movies, that's documented huge diebacks, 30% of the Great Barrier Reef dying. These are things that the climate models, based on our past rates of warming the planet, we thought we wouldn't see for decades to centuries, and they're coming so much sooner. So we do, the caller's right, we do need to start redefining these in an era of climate change as a fact.
A few more comments I'd like to get your response to. Ripu writes about Senate Bill 100, and that's a bill that would require California to receive all of its power from renewable energy by 2045. And wants to know what your opinion would be on the bill, and would you like to see nuclear power included as a qualifying zero CO2 energy source? I'm also getting questions about, what California should do more as a role that it has taken up as a leader in fighting climate change.
Yeah, so a great question. I mean, California is on path to right now meet our 2020 target of getting a third of our power from renewables, and the 2030 target is 50%, and now a Senate Bill 100, as you say, is to go to 100% in 2045, and based on the modeling work that my lab and some others are doing, we think this is an achievable goal. We do not have all the technology in place, but the rapid and dramatic improvement in energy storage, in conventional chemical batteries, in liquid flow batteries, there's a whole variety of new technologies that give us a great deal of confidence that we can not only do this, we've known that for a long time, but we can do this cost effectively. So this is a goal that makes sense. And the question about nuclear, perhaps one of the most divisive features, and I say this as a professor of nuclear engineering at Berkeley, is that I would very much like nuclear to be able to play a role, but it has to prove that it's up to the task. And this is the real sad part of the story, and that is that not only due to the accidents, but the costs, the overruns in time, the lack of flexibility of nuclear power to basically play in a dynamic market the way other technologies can do, nuclear will have to rise to the challenge. And so far, we have these old legacy baseload plants. There's a great deal of enthusiasm from the Bill Gateses and many others of the world that the next generation of nuclear can play a big role. But meeting those targets, in particular of safety and of cost, are going to be huge challenges. And there's a great deal of very valid skepticism that nuclear is just going to be ready to play an added role in meeting those targets. So I'd like to see it, but it's got to prove that it's up to it. And so far, I would
say you also have the ongoing vexing and profoundly serious dilemma about what to do about nuclear waste. But what about cellulosic ethanol, which, again, Breitbart really went after you about, which you were advocating?
Well, it's funny. It's kind of a silly story on their part that there's been a great deal of interest in California and elsewhere in making cellulosic ethanol work. Berkeley and many other universities were able to attract large grants and research money. And the more research that we did, the more we found that getting sustainable enough biofuels was such a challenge that there might be small amounts of urban waste or other things that could be part of the story, but California and many other jurisdictions have pivoted to electrified transportation as a cleaner, not only in terms of out of the tailpipe, but the life cycle analysis and actually the work that my laboratory did to develop one of those early life cycle models for which I went on 60 Minutes in various shows, highlighted that if one could not manage the land use impacts, that there were other options that should be on the table. And thankfully, California reflected that. We worked hard to develop what's called the low carbon fuel standard for California that says all low carbon fuels can be used to meet our obligation, but they only get a role based on how clean they are. And electricity has far trumped, if you will, biofuels. And so their role is much, much larger today. And that trend looks like it's going to continue.
And let's go to our callers, and we begin, Anthony, with you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot. As I understand the conversation I just tuned in, is we're discussing the effects of climate change on major natural disasters.
Yes.
Hello?
I'm sorry. Did you have a question, Anthony?
Yes. The question is, what type of relations in the climate change effect are we seeing between the hurricane going on in the Gulf at Texas and the one and the massive floods going on in India, which are killing thousands more?
Dan Kamen?
Tricky one. I am not aware right now of research linking these two directly. They both have to do with increased intensity of storms and of extreme weather events, as they're called. The events for Harvey are fairly well understood in terms of a warmer ocean means that evaporation is easier, which then puts a great deal more water into the system that Harvey is now dumping. Again, these sort of record numbers, 50 inches I mentioned before. But that is a process that we know will happen from the science because the sea surface, the ocean surface temperatures in the Gulf are so much warmer than we would expect. And that's exactly what the climate models say. And again, this is not just a Harvey-related event. Some of these recent heat waves that have been studied in a great deal of detail, we still have a hard time saying exactly what percentage. I'm not sure we'll ever say that precisely. But the effects that we're seeing, the extreme events, their destructiveness, are exactly in line with what the climate science says we should expect. And that means, of course, that we are already paying a great cost for climate change, due to climate change. And so when we debate, should there be a price on carbon? Should we have these various ways to pay back? We're already paying a huge amount. The question is, can we adjust our economy? Can we take advantage of this to build a clean energy economy in time to prevent the worst effects that may be coming our way?
Let me thank Anthony for the call and go right to another caller. And Nick is joining us next. Nick, you're on the air.
Okay, hi. You just mentioned cap and trade, and we see that it's been manipulated by fossil fuel interests to delay rapid emission reductions. So the other method of pricing carbon is a carbon tax. But how can a carbon tax or fee be levied without imposing a drag on our economy or disproportionately hurting low-income residents?
So this is a great question, because it's really been the debate about the two strategies. Do you have a market, and then do you then allow companies to buy and sell credits, or do you simply have a tax across the board? And actually, I wrote recently in Scientific American that from our analysis, the ideal combination for us in the U.S. would ironically be a combination of the so-called Clean Power Plan, which is the Obama plan, to reduce emissions and to impose that. And then what's called by many the conservative approach, which has been exposed by Baker and Secretaries of State Schultz and others. And what they argued is we should have what the caller described, essentially a tax on carbon, but then to rebate money back to Americans, citizens. And my preferred route would actually be to rebate a disproportionate amount to low-income Americans, so a tax and rebate, but to have that rebate declining with income so that the poor were made more than whole and the rich paid a proportionally larger amount, but also not just to give it all back, but to harvest some of it for what we know we need, and that's research on clean energy technologies, research on adaptation, investment in supporting poor communities, so-called environmental justice efforts. And thankfully, that's exactly what California has put together under Senate Bill 32, the extension of our climate bill from 2020 onwards. And so the question gets at some deep economics, but we actually look at the clean energy economy and see the more we invest in these areas, and I really want to call out a group, Next 10, in Northern California, that does a lot of the analysis of this, as highlighting that investments in the clean tech economy build jobs and are actually accelerators, not drags on the economy.
Talking with Dan Kamen, and he's professor of energy at UC Berkeley, and some pushback on Paris from James. Dan, he says, there was no Paris climate deal. Does your guest realize that other signatories are planning to build 500 gigawatts of new coal-fired power plants? That isn't a climate deal.
Well, that's true, although I think James might have the numbers wrong a bit. What the climate deal said is that cities, states, nations, and in particular countries are signing up for a path to get under 2 degrees of total warming, which we've already about halfway there, sadly, here in 2017. And so the climate deal calls for everyone to develop plans. Some countries emphasizing switching to clean energy, others preserving forests, others preserving wetlands. And so in areas where their emissions are below that, there is some room to grow, not a lot, but a little bit of room to grow their fossil fuel their economies to support their citizens. But for most of the world, it is a path to cut. And even with the U.S. Under Mr. Trump pulling out of the climate deal, Governor Brown, Governor of New York State, Washington, many others have set up their own subnational coalition to basically make Paris real. In fact, Governor Brown is the co-chair of a global effort called the Under 2 Accord that has hundreds of municipalities around the world that have signed on to make the Paris deal possible. And we are seeing economic benefits of that from California to rural Kenya, a place where I work with the governor's office to assist their county, like Kipia District in Kenya, in developing a plan. So we see this as pro-economy, pro-growth, but there are a few places that do have some headroom to grow a bit of fossil fuel emissions.
Well, whenever nuclear power comes up, and it's come up in our conversation, somehow thorium does come up, and I think Chris wants to address that. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if your guest could just address thorium, and is there a future for thorium in the United States or California? And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Dan Campbell.
Chris has a great question. So the issue for thorium is that it is another nuclear fuel source, and it's one that is very, very proliferation resistant. It's very hard to make the thorium fuel into some of the weapons. That's one of the big concerns. The issue is that the U.S. decades ago put its nuclear effort around the uranium-plutonium supply, not thorium. We do not have a large supply of thorium. Turns out India does. And so India has a big discussion to do so. But essentially, the cost of nuclear plants is so high, more than $10 billion and more than 10 years to construct. And some people think $20 billion is a number for the standard plant. These are just very expensive, very slow to build. And one of the results of that is that for these conventional, these large nuclear plants, there's just simply not enough money in the U.S. system to invest in a uranium-based pathway and a thorium-based pathway. Now, the interesting variable is that a number of individuals, I mentioned Bill Gates before, are very bullish around small modular reactors that they say would be able to actually bring their costs down by mass production. Something we've seen for other technologies, but nuclear has never achieved. And one of the areas for those sort of hopeful that nuclear will play a bigger role is that these technologies can get nuclear on the same so-called learning curve that we've seen for solar, wind, storage, and others, but nuclear has not seen. And that's a challenge because we need to install a huge amount of clean energy by 2050, and whether nuclear can play a role in that is going to be a function of how quickly they can have a commercially viable, safe, and cheap product. And there's a lot of skepticism that that will happen in time.
Again, our guest is Dan Kamen, professor of energy at UC Berkeley. Dan, we're coming to the end of this segment, unfortunately. But a quick response to you from a question a listener named Joe raises. He says, what should the federal government do to avoid catastrophic climate change? And wants to know if you're familiar with and what you think of Project Drawdown.
So Project Drawdown is a wonderful effort. It's essentially a number of it's sort of a collection of best practices in different areas in installing solar, in investing in storage, in making communities more climate adapted and safe. And it's really a wonderful recipe, and it's the kind of thing that I wish the federal government would really take to heart and say, we find opportunity after opportunity, like in California, like in New York State, to invest in clean energy, to make our agriculture smarter, to make it more environmentally just across socioeconomic and racial groups, and to use this as a chance to redirect the economy as opposed to what we're seeing from Mr. Trump, which is sadly just not in our energy or climate best interest.
And we'll have to leave it there. Dan Kamen, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Dan Kamen, again, is professor of energy at UC Berkeley and directs the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at UC Berkeley. Up ahead, speaking of UC Berkeley, we're going to talk with Professor Emeritus of UC Berkeley, Frederick Cruz, who has another book out on Freud. It's called The Making of an Illusion. Stay tuned for that. Thank you for being a part of this opening hour of Forum. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.